I'm not confused. I'm just wrong.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. Now, we've never been a division. We were created in 1959 as a board.
As a board, okay. All right.
The Marine Board has requested Senate Bill 175 in an effort to strengthen and improve our existing laws that prohibit the operation of a boat while intoxicated, or BUII. The bill makes the treatment of persons under age 21 who operate a boat more consistent with Oregon's driving under the influence laws, which provide a zero blood alcohol concentration for persons under age 21. We think this bill creates a consistent message. If you're under age 21, no amount of alcohol is permitted while operating a motor vehicle or a boat. 16 other states have already enacted zero tolerance laws for BUII for persons under 21. Another 5 states have significantly lower BAC levels for persons under 21, standards such as 0.01 or 0.02, which for all intents and purposes are zero tolerance. This bill also makes a change in our law for field sobriety testing and chemical testing to make those two more consistent by deleting a reference to motorboats and sailboats in ORS 830.510 subsection 4. That's on line 19 of the bill. That reference in the bill creates an inconsistency. Under current law, we have implied consent for field sobriety tests that apply to all persons operating a boat on Oregon's waterways. However, implied consent for chemical testing is limited by the reference in subsection 4. We believe that removal of this reference will provide a more consistent policy for field and chemical testing when necessary for all persons operating boats on Oregon's waterways. These changes have been requested and reviewed by the Marine Patrol officers in the interest of improving our BUII law and making our waterways safer. The Western States Marine Officers Association has endorsed this bill, and I have a copy of their endorsement that I have attached to my testimony. We don't believe there's any significant fiscal impact associated with the bill. We've talked with the trial courts as they're preparing that statement. I don't believe you have it yet. But the number of cases that we're dealing with here are probably in the order, based on history, of about 10 a year or less. That's our last three-year history.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Is that 10 total, including minors?
10 minor cases.
10 minor cases.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, could you tell me why you're just limiting this to alcohol? Is there another statute that deals with other intoxicants, such as marijuana, methamphetamine, any of those kinds of drugs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, our law does speak to intoxicating liquor or other intoxicating substances as well, so it's not limited to alcohol, but this provides zero tolerance for alcohol, the presence of alcohol. We do make other cases are made based on drugs. We've had several cases in the last few years where there was a zero BAC, but the person was still arrested and charged because they were under the influence of something other than alcohol.
I don't see it in this statute. Is it in this statute here?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, no, it's in other portions of the BUII laws.
Okay. And does that apply to persons under 21 operating a boat as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, the sections dealing with being under the influence of other chemicals would apply to all persons.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions, counsel?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I wanted to make one clarification that Paul and I talked about beforehand, is that for a driver on a highway who's under 21, the law for the crime of driving under the influence of intoxicants, it still requires a .08 for a driver under 21. However, I think what Mr. Don Hefner is referring to is for the implied consent for your driver's license, a person under 21 is treated differently if they have any alcohol, their license is suspended. And I put a copy of that law in your packet. And if you look at 813.130(2)(c), you'll see that that's applied to the driving suspension.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Burdick.
How would this, maybe this is a question for council, but how would this law interact with the law that prohibits anyone under 21 from possessing alcohol?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, you would still have to prove that the person has drank it. You could still charge both, basically. You could charge MIP, minor in possession, and charge boating under the influence of intoxicants. So there would be an interaction in that you could charge both in those situations where you could not show that there was an 08. You could still charge this. But
another question is, in the motor vehicle statutes, under some circumstances, vehicles can be impounded. Is there any provision for boats being impounded?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I believe most of the impounds, as I recall, they do not apply to boats. Paul, if you want to correct me on that. But there are also, a lot of those are at the local county level, too, like even for DUIs, so maybe probably know the local.
There's no provision for impounding the boat.
Although, because this is a crime, correct? The boat could be impounded as prisoner's property.
That's what
property? Prisoner's property. You're not going to leave it floating on a lake someplace. You'll take it into custody and put it somewhere until prisoner's released from custody or whatever, I assume.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not entirely certain of that.
You can't exactly park a boat and leave it on the side of the street. So,
the detection, arrest, and prosecution of BUII is much more complicated than DUII because of the environment in which it takes place. Ordinarily, officers would try to turn the control of the boat over to another family member, friend, or somebody else at the scene, as opposed to trying to impound it or take it into custody.
And I assume that would be reasonable if that was an option. But if it's not an option, I guess what I'm trying to say to the committee is the officer has the authority to take that property into custody as prisoner's property to store it, charge the prisoner for the cost of storage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, property. So that makes any sense. But there's a difference between impounding and seizure or forfeiture, too, so keep that in mind. All right, other questions? None? Don, thank you very much. Kelly Sky, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Good morning.
We don't have the ACLU on this one, though, do we?
No. Chair Minnis, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Sky. I'm a legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and our organization opposes this bill for a number of reasons. The first reason is just on a public policy level. We have a concern when our default position is criminalizing behavior that we deem to be problematic, especially when that behavior is on behalf of our youth. In this particular bill would encumber our youth with a criminal conviction in a situation that creates very serious consequences that will live with them for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. It's important for you to understand that offenses under the traffic code may be prosecuted in an adult court, and in most counties, Multnomah County in particular, there is a blanket waiver of juveniles into adult court on traffic offenses. So if you have a 14 or 15-year-old who's arrested under this provision, they will be waived into adult court, prosecuted as an adult, put on adult supervision, and it's a conviction that will stick with them for the rest of their lives. Traffic offenses are not expungible, so it's an offense that would not be expungible from the person's record.
Right. But if they have good credit, their insurance rates will be low. Sorry.
This must be something I missed.
Yeah.
So, and at a public policy level, criminalizing behavior that we deem to be problematic can also be an expensive default position with no proven deterrent effect, especially among youth. Further, this creates a legal fiction. Voting under the influence carries with it certain connotations. When you see it on someone's record currently, what it means is that someone did more than drink one beer and operate a boat. They drank enough to be affected to a noticeable and perceptible effect, or that their blood alcohol was above a 0.08. That conviction carries astigmatism with it, and that is astigmatism. If you have someone who's under 21, say they're 19 or 20 years old, they have one beer on a boat, the stigmatism of having a boating under the influence conviction on their record, it's a legal fiction that they actually had drank to a level where they're operating the boat was a danger.
Well, let me challenge you on that for just a second, because I do understand what you're saying, but I also understand that a police officer, a deputy sheriff who is who would enforce this statute, in order to get to the point where you would actually do a chemical analysis and invoke that process, they're going to have to articulate some facts, some circumstance that leads them to believe that a particular individual has alcohol in their system. And I would submit to you that the mere presence of alcohol in a boat would not be sufficient to do that. And so help me understand from your perspective.
Chairman, you are correct. Under current law, they would need to be able to articulate specific facts to get them there. But if this became the law, I think that there would be an exception. If they knew or had reason to believe that a person was under the age of 21, then the mere presence of an open can of beer on a boat would probably get you there, because they don't have to have reasonable, articulable facts to suggest that the person was affected.
But help me, because I mean that is a problem area if in fact what you're saying is true, because you're talking about taking a person into custody, depriving mm-hmm. them of their liberty based on you shouldn't do it and can't do it, I think constitutionally, under a set of assumptions. You have to do it based on a set of facts that rise to a level of probable cause. So I don't know that this law overturns that probable cause necessity. I mean, even if it was enacted, I don't know that it overturns that articulation of facts that would be necessary to support a conviction.
You're absolutely correct, Chair Minnis. It does not overturn that. But when someone was under 21, all the officer would need is reasonable suspicion in order to stop the person, probable
right.
cause in order to arrest. But a reason to believe that they had any amount of alcohol, only a sip, whereas if they're over 21, the officer has to have probable cause to believe that they've had enough to get them to a 0.08 or to affect them to a noticeable and perceptible level.
Correct.
So that's where, the officers are frequently looking for slurred speech and things like that. They won't need that in order to arrest a juvenile. All they will need is some reason to believe that this juvenile's had as much as one or two sips of beer.
No, I disagree with you. I think that being a law enforcement officer, if I was going to take one of these cases to court, I think I'd get blown out of water sitting in a jury box when I explained to them that the only thing I saw was an open container, and I'm assuming that there would be other people present in the boat, not just
mm-hmm.
a single person. I think that articulation of a single person in a boat with an open can of beer and the odor of alcohol in the boat, I would have to articulate, I believe, that this person displayed an odor of alcohol coming from their breath, or perhaps bloodshot eyes, maybe not slurred speech, or maybe I ask the person, have you consumed any alcohol, and they say, yes, I have.
Mm-hmm.
That then would get me to the level of probable cause. But I cannot envision a judge or a court, accepting my testimony that, yes, I stopped this boat because it didn't have the flag and they were doing water skiing and I saw an open container, so I took this person into custody because he's under 18 so that I could test him to see if he violated this law. I just don't think constitutionally I can get there.
And, Chairman, I agree under the circumstances that you just mentioned. I think you probably have to have something to suggest a connection between the can of beer and the person who's driving the boat.
Right. I mean, I remember a police officer in Scappoose had actually arrested a juvenile for minor in possession taking beer bottles back to the store. I mean, I'd submit to you his decision was not a real good one, and that conviction didn't occur. I mean, it was a dumb mistake on that police officer's part. And that's why I'm suggesting here that to get this kind of a conviction in court, the officer's going to have to articulate some facts and circumstances to support their belief that this person has consumed alcohol.
Right.
Now, the only difference that I can see is where we do currently have minor possession by consumption, where we would take a child into custody for protective custody purposes, which is a status offense for juveniles, and it is a jump between that status offense and a criminal conviction, any misdemeanor. So I can see that part of it. Anybody else have an issue? We've got more testimony probably.
I have a couple other points I wanted to make. One is that BUII, it's a Class A misdemeanor, same possible consequences as a DUII. As you're all probably aware, a DUII carries a statutory diversion program so that on a person's first offense they can go through the diversion program and it will not appear on their record as a DUI conviction. It appears as a diversion. Some would argue that there's not a whole lot of difference there, but there are some differences. There is no diversion program for boating under the influence. And in speaking with some of our members who primarily defend driving under the influence cases, they inform me that routinely when they represent somebody on a BUII and they try to get them into the diversion program, routinely prosecutors will object and routinely judges will deny. Now, in speaking with, and I apologize, I forgot his name, the gentleman from the Marine Board, he indicated that he is aware that in some places courts have created their own diversion programs. And he was telling me about Jackson County, where Jackson County has created their own informal BUI diversion program. But that's not required under the statute. Under the statute, only DUIs are allowed into diversion. So in this situation, you may have a 20-year-old who has half a beer. It shows up on a breath chemical test, and they will now have a conviction on the record for the rest of their life, whereas a 25-year-old who goes out and drives and has a .08 can go into diversion. So this law does not necessarily bring BUI into line with DUI. It actually makes it more serious consequences for the youth in particular. Say for instance a 20-year-old is convicted of BUI and is court-ordered into a alcohol program. That court-ordered alcohol program has consequences because they would no longer be eligible for a DUI diversion program in the future. As I mentioned earlier, this is not expungible, so no matter how young the youth is, this would never be expunged from their record. And as mentioned already, it is already illegal for someone under 21 to drink. It's already illegal for them to possess alcohol or to consume it. Possession of alcohol by a minor can be proved by consumption. And under the statutes, on a second offense for minor in possession, the court can order a person into alcohol treatment. So there are some provisions in the law. I stretch to suggest that perhaps the fact that there are only approximately 10 cases a year suggests that some of those laws are actually doing what they need to be doing already. The other concern that I wanted to raise is the deletion of Section 1, Sub 4, and what that effectively will do is to make the implied consent law apply to canoes, rowboats. So we're in a situation where under this bill, someone, you know, 19, 20 years old, goes out in a rowboat and they have a beer and they could end up with a DUII conviction on their record for the rest of their life. So
you get a DUII for riding a bicycle, though, too. So.
Well, I have issues with that as well, but okay. We don't need to go into that. So that concludes the issues that I wanted to bring up.
All right, thank you. Senator Rinko, I think, has a comment or question.
Thank you. You keep saying it would be on their record for the rest of their life. Is that not the case for minor in possession?
No, it's not.
I see. Okay.
Chairman and Senator Rinko, minor in possession is a violation, but even if it were a crime, crimes are expungible from a person's record. Traffic offenses are not. So, and because BUII, although it's not a driving traffic, it's in the vehicle code, so it's considered non-expungible.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions? Council.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I wanted to make one thing clear. Ms. Skye, for boating under the influence of intoxicants, that applies to all boats, correct, currently?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. Just want to make that. So that the, and to clarify, you were saying that this deleting that would change the implied consent laws as opposed to the crime of boating under the influence, correct?
That's my understanding, and I must confess, Chairman and members of the committee, I did not notice this little deletion provision, and it was the gentleman from the Marine Board who pointed that out to me this morning. So I have not gone back and read all of, or can't identify for you what 830505 through 830545 contains, but the gentleman from the Marine Board pointed this out and explained it to me.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
and members of the committee, it applies to the implied consent rule, so the chemical testing and then related to your suspension, this would eliminate the distinction between boats, all boats, and currently you can't be under the influence of intoxicants operating any boat, which, by the way, is means every description of watercraft, including a seaplane on the water and not in flight, used or capable of being used as a means of transportation on the water, but does not include boathouses, floating homes, air mattresses, beach and water toys, or single inner tubes.
So we might upset the entire world if you can't. You can't get inner tubes.
Yeah, we got to keep that. Mr. Chairman, I am from Southern Oregon, and I need to do my annual Rogue River float.
Rogue River float thing.
So this would the change then would make the implied consent apply to all those watercraft that are that are designated boats,
all right,
but does not change the fact that boating under the influence of intoxicants currently does apply to all those.
So I have a question in response to that. So you could go on a romantic night on the canal in Eugene and Alton Baker Park in your canoe with a bottle of champagne and some chocolate and if you drink too much of that, you could be arrested for BUII.
And if you're under 21, you can be.
Yeah, if you're under 21, you can't do it.
And you're toast.
It shouldn't be. Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, Senator White, that's correct. I mean, a canoe would technically apply. I don't know how that's applied in the real world. I suspect that they would maybe use their discretion and let the moonlight cruise continue on there.
Yeah, have to be a pretty slow crime night, I would think. Pretty bored. Thank you very much. Don, can you come up for just a second? I am Paul, excuse me. I don't know why I called you. Oh, it's Don Hefner.
Paul Don Hefner.
It's way too early to have a committee. But anyway, in my experience here in the legislature, the few times we've worked on voting laws in this issue, I don't recall that we've ever talked about the diversion statutes applying to boats and driving under the influence of a boat. I've always just assumed that they would apply. Is there some rationale for not having them apply?
Mr. Chairman, there's no formal diversion provisions in the BUII statutes. As was stated earlier, some counties, such as Jackson and others, have, between the district attorney and the court, adopted their own diversion programs, which might include things such as alcohol counseling, attending a voting safety class, some other sanctions such as that, short of jail time and or and or fines.
All right.
But there's no formal statewide program for that.
All right. Now, would your board have an objection to making these provisions?
Creating a diversion
program statewide?
We would be open to discussion of that.
Because it seems to me if we're going to apply this to people under the age of 21 having zero tolerance, then there ought to be some way that someone who's made a mistake and clearly, you know, has the ability to reform themselves has an opportunity to do that. And that's my thought. Maybe I'm turning into a liberal or something here, but it seems to me that some people do go out and they make a mistake and do something stupid, and, you know, young people have a tendency to do that more so than older people based on experience. So it seems to me that in the judgment of the court, if they thought a diversion was appropriate, that would seem to work for me. Senator Ringo.
Well, Mr. Chair, I had a question. I apologize for being late. I don't understand what it means to enact a zero tolerance law. I mean, I don't know if you touched upon that. To me, it's like, okay, we're not going to tolerate it, we're going to take you out and shoot you. That's zero tolerance.
That would be in Texas.
So, seriously, what do you mean by zero tolerance?
Mr. Chairman, can we start with the attorney?
Who would you defend?
Exactly. Paul, do you have any response to that?
I'll try, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo. Perhaps it's not the right term, but zero tolerance is to suggest that if you're a person under the age of 21, you're not supposed to be drinking alcohol in Oregon, period. And so rather than saying that we have to prove that you're all the way to a .08 before you can be arrested and prosecuted for voting under the influence, we're saying that since you're not supposed to be drinking at all, that the standard is lowered, and in this case we're suggesting the standard of 0-0. There's five other states there's 16 other states that have adopted the same 0-0 for persons under 21. There's five others that have gone with 0-1 or 0-2, which for all intents and purposes I think one would say is a zero tolerance as well.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry. You have a question?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you. I guess I'm a little unclear as to what the problem that's being addressed here is. Is the problem that under the current statute you don't have enough authority to test them, or what are you trying to accomplish here with this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, currently we have the authority to test them, to arrest them and test them, and we have to prove a standard of .08. And in looking at other state programs as well as Oregon's highway program, where we say that any amount of alcohol in your bloodstream is put you over the line for driving, we think we ought to be able to send that same message that any amount of alcohol in your system operating a boat also puts you over the line if you're under age 21.
Okay. So
in other words, we're saying if you're driving a car, you can't have any alcohol in your system if you're under 21. But if you're operating a boat, it's okay to be .07.
Yeah. To refresh me again, what is the penalty for counsel under 21 if you have any amount of alcohol?
Mr. Chairman and senators, this is I think an area of confusion. Still, for DUII, driving under the influence of intoxicants, to be convicted of that crime, which is a Class A misdemeanor, if you're 21 or you're over 21 or under 21, it still has to be .08. I think Mr. Don Heffner is referring to your suspension. If you're under 21 and you're caught with any alcohol, zero tolerance, then your driving license can be suspended, but it's not a crime.
So does that would not be a permanent part of your record?
Oh, I mean, it would be on your driving record, but that can be taken off. It's not a crime. It's not a traffic offense, and that's what Ms. Skye was referring to when she was saying that it's a non-expungible offense, would be a conviction for DUI.
But not a suspension.
Correct. Okay.
So what would the comparable, in the voting, in the wonderful world of voting, what would be the comparable remedy to a suspension?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, we don't have a comparable remedy in suspension since there's no license per se. Oregon does have a mandatory voter education program, but those certificates are not revocable. They're good for life, and they merely prove that you've taken a voting safety course. The court could order your privileges suspended, but without a license to revoke, it is difficult to say that that would have any effect.
Okay, and would there be anything to prevent you from, if you tested someone under 21 and found some alcohol, would there be anything to stop you from charging them with minor in possession?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burke, no, there would be nothing to prevent minor in possession.
I'm sitting here talking to counsel about one issue, and that is when we assume that you need a .08 to convict, that is not true, at least under the auto statutes. I was trying to get clarification. If the officer could demonstrate that the person's actions were perceptibly adversely affected to the point they couldn't operate the motor vehicle, you could convict on a .01, but then you would have to bring other evidence into trial that indicate that's actions correct. And conduct right. And behaviors and other kinds of observations that would rise to the level of a proof beyond reasonable doubt that the jury would say, yeah, this person was pretty well messed up and so on and so
that,
forth.
That is correct. In fact, some people are convicted with a .00 because they're under the influence of drugs.
Okay, so and I think for the committee it's important. You can do that in voting, can you not?
Yes.
Okay.
But you have to, for example, with alcohol, be able to then articulate that they're impaired.
Correct. And this, the difference here is I don't think you would have to articulate any impairment at all, would you? Just the mere presence of the alcohol. So it is a pretty low threshold.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, while you were having that discussion, I also asked if they could charge him with MIP if they got any amount of alcohol, and the answer was yes. So yeah. There is a remedy already available for finding any amount of alcohol, even if it's short of legal impairment.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Walker.
Yes, Senator Burdick, there is Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, there is another charge that minors can be charged with, and it's MIC, minor in consumption. So that's a remedy as well. And that can be expunged on a minor's record.
All right, any other questions? Senator Rigo.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just have a question or comment, and invite your response, I guess. I wonder, what is the purpose for increasing a penalty or imposing a penalty? And you step back and think, a couple things. One is it might be to get the bad guy off the street for a while just to make the world a safer place. Obviously, that doesn't apply here. We're not going to be taking anybody off the street or, and another is deterrence, to try to just send the message that, this we will not tolerate this. It's a zero tolerance policy. And I guess in this case, here we're looking at young people that have already decided to break the law by possessing alcohol. And I just don't see how they're even going to know that in 2003 the legislature did something to change the nature of a violation, and that would be a deterrent to them. And so I'm just wondering what is the reason to do this, because I don't see deterrence. So I'm not sure what it accomplishes.
Paul, do you have a response to that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, the deterrence would come in being able to, as part of our education efforts, which is a big part of the deterrence, to be able to tell people that if you're under age 21, drinking and voting is a no-no. I mean,
but I don't understand that. It's already a no-no.
Well,
it's already against the law. Now it's against another law. And you'd say, okay, it was okay for us to, we chose to violate one law, but you're right. We might, now that it's a second violation, maybe we won't do that. Do you really think that would happen?
Well, currently, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, we can... Sending a message that voting and drinking is going to get you a minor in possession isn't quite the same as the message of saying, you know, voting and drinking is a crime, and if you're under 21, any amount of alcohol in your system is going to put you over the limit. And on the highway side of it, the message isn't if you're under 21 and you're stopped driving a motor vehicle that the consequence is you're going to get an MIP. The consequence is at least you're going to lose your license,
right,
and possibly more.
Yeah.
And that has a deterrent effect.
I very much understand the safety issue, and I think that's the goal, was to create safer waterways. I'm just wondering whether that this accomplishes that.
A couple of issues in my mind, too, is that the legislature takes this step and applies a zero tolerance to boats, but doesn't apply the same principle to automobile driving, because it seems to me that would equally apply to automobiles, that there ought to be a zero tolerance for DUIs for persons under 21. And so I guess I'd want to look at that, so that what the public statement would be and what perception the public would have of the legislature, the state's view of driving under the influence for anyone, whether you're a boat or a car, under the age of 21. But second, if we did take that step, it would seem to me that diversion ought to apply, so that the...
Sorry.
Oh, that's you.
Sorry.
So that technology is disrupting our entire process here, so that judges would know that they have an opportunity to divert someone. So that would make sense to me. So maybe I think I'll close the public hearing now, and we'll have some time to talk with the members of the committee and see what their wisdom is, where we want to go with this, anywhere at all. All right. Paul, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Close the public hearing. If there's any way we can work with the committee to save you from Temple of Doom, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much.
Temple of Doom.
All right. Now, we're going to move on into a public hearing on Senate Bill 178, and this one has something to do with something I never want to be associated with, and that's extreme fighting. I've been beat up enough in my life, so who's first here? Matt Lindland? Who is that? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I might change the order of presentation.
You
My name is Richard Franklin. We kind of threw it down.
Are you one of these extreme fighters?
There's a couple of us.
Okay,
here.
You guys can do whatever you want.
Okay, can we all three come up?
You can all come up. Yes, you can.
Wow. Get to see a fight.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members
Just
of the committee.
Do me a favor. You have to introduce yourself to the record so that the clerk can...
Yeah, Richard Franklin. I reside at 4296 Southeast Bethesda Place in Gresham, Oregon.
Okay.
Chairman Minnis, members of the committee, my name is Chael Sonnen. I reside at 23172 Southwest Stafford Road, just in Tualatin, Oregon.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Lindland. I reside in Eagle Creek, Oregon at 20405 Terralera Lane.
All right. So who's going to start with the testimony this morning?
How about Rick Franklin?
Okay.
Chairman Minnis, members of the committee. We appear not necessarily for or against the amendments to the Boxing and Wrestling Commission statute, but to clarify a few points. And it's probably best if we bifurcate. I would like to speak a little bit about the extreme fighting statute, but probably first to point out to the committee that the statute is, in our opinion, overbroad, in that what is happening here is that the Boxing and Wrestling Commission wants authority now over amateur wrestling. Prior to that, if one carefully reads the statute, the Boxing and Wrestling Commission had authority only over professional events, those events in which the contestants receive some form of compensation or purse. The amendments that you see before you were drafted largely to deal with ongoing mixed martial arts or pancration events, which again is a separate issue. But the amendments go too far, again, because they contemplate governing amateur wrestling events. For example, amateur freestyle and Greco wrestling events, which are Olympic sports. Oregon has a very storied tradition in Olympic wrestling. There used to be 20 spots on an Olympic team, then there were 16, now there are 14 wrestling spots on an Olympic team. The state of Oregon, which is virtual backwater as far as population and those things are concerned, has managed to put one or two members on each Olympic team since 1968. Have the privilege of having one sitting next to me on my left, Matt Lindland, who won an Olympic silver medal in 2000 in Sydney. And on my right, Chael Sonnen was Olympic alternate, was the number three man in the nation as a senior in college, which is virtually unheard of. Both All-Americans out of Mr. Sonnen, University of Oregon, Mr. Lindland out of University of Nebraska. If the Boxing and Wrestling Commission starts governing amateur wrestling, it will be very problematic. Now, there is an exemption for the Boxing and Wrestling Commission to exempt out certain organizations, for example, USA Wrestling, if it so desires. But there is, in fact, no process by which the Boxing and Wrestling Commission recognizes an amateur organization. As a matter of fact, the Boxing and Wrestling Commissioner, at this time, James Cassidy, has indicated he's never done so. He's never recognized a separate amateur organization and would not know how to do so if he was asked. There are no provisions in the administrative rules of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission that provides a process for recognizing any other amateur organizations. There are rules, however, in the Boxing and Wrestling Commission administrative rules that provide how a wrestling contest would be conducted. If one spends time looking at the statute and the administrative rules, they get the very clear impression that the wrestling rules were designed for that spectacle we recognize to be professional wrestling. So if you take the overlay of the rules that exist for Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and for example, if we were privileged enough to have the World Cup of Wrestling staged in Oregon, it's been staged twice in Spokane, Washington in recent years, will be staged in Boise, Idaho in April of this year, where we invite teams from around the world to compete in a national event, we would arguably have to stage the event, assuming it was approved, with a ring with turnbuckles and ropes, a timer with a bell, a referee that would pretend not to see about 90% of the action, and it would be a fiasco. So that is one of the primary concerns that I want to share with the committee at this time, is that the statute is overbroad. Now, we have made overtures to the Department of Justice, both when they passed an administrative rule that attempted to deal with amateur sports, and when we dealt with the Department of Justice in the court proceedings over in front of Judge Lipscomb dealing with the extreme fighting issue, that we would be willing to work with you to come up with an administrative rule or rules that will exempt out amateur wrestling, and so that particular competition could be protected. We've never been taken up on that particular offer. Now, before we move into the extreme fighting issue, I'd be happy to field any questions that you might have.
Do me a favor and clarify again what it is you don't want the Boxing and Wrestling Commission to regulate.
Well, we don't want the Boxing and Wrestling Commission to regulate international freestyle and international Greco-Roman, which are Olympic sports.
Okay, now, it's been a long time since I did this stuff way back in high school, 30 years ago, but you got the amateur athletic associations and different the stuff that happened in high school and collegiate wrestling, correct?
That's correct, and those are exempt as long as they're put on by the university or the school.
Okay. Other organizations, like I'm thinking Multnomah Athletic Club when Rick Sanders was a wrestler there.
That's correct. Well, it used to be AAU, now it's USA Wrestling.
Okay.
That changed, I understand, because of an apartheid issue and a fallout there, so they created their own separate entity, USA Wrestling, which is the national governing body. And each state has their own organization that puts on their national qualifiers for the juniors.
A lot of Olympic athletes come out of those kind of organizations, don't they?
Pardon?
A lot of Olympic athletes come out of those kind of organizations. I remember Rick Sanders didn't go to the Olympics until he'd been teaching wrestling and coaching wrestling at the MAC club.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, most Olympic wrestlers matriculate through the university procedure, and then they compete 3 or 4 years internationally and get the skill level to make an Olympic team. But, yeah, that's exactly where they come from, USA Wrestling-sponsored open event.
Okay. Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Could you just give a little bit of your background that brings you here today?
Well, I'm an attorney. I used to wrestle in high school and college, and I have some limited international wrestling experience. I'm also a referee at the NC2A level, and I am a fan of amateur wrestling. And if you're a wrestler, you know virtually every other wrestler, either by coaching them or seeing them at tournaments or by refereeing them. And so that's why I'm here, and that's my particular interest, and that's how I know these gentlemen to my right and my left.
Thank you.
All right. I'm remembering names, Junior Johnson and some of the old guys. That's back. I'm dating myself, I think.
Yeah. Junior Johnson's now a coach at a youth club.
Yeah.
Coaches freestyle wrestling.
All right. I think he actually coached one of my my high school youth wrestling camps or something I went to here somewhere. Anyway, all right. Who's next?
I'll go next, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Basically, I just came here to reiterate what Rick has said.
And you're Matt Leland, right?
I'm Matt Leland. And basically, my background in the sport is I grew up in the state of Oregon, wrestled through the programs, wrestled in the USA Wrestling sanctioned events onto the Olympics in 2000. I was a medalist there. And I don't like the way the law is written because it encompasses this sport, but I also, like we said before, we'll probably talk about the extreme fighting part of this law as well, because I'm also a mixed martial arts competitor, which in some people's minds or vision, that is considered extreme fighting. My opinion on the sport is a little different than somebody who looks at it as a no-holds-barred event. I look at it as a form of mixed martial arts, another kind of martial art. And wrestling, to me, is the true martial art that I studied and has taken me to the level to where I was able to accomplish what I needed to do in my life. I don't think without the sport of wrestling or without the amateur level, I would have been able to go on to a college, get my education, go on to win an Olympic medal, work with children, and to help develop the kids programs in the state of Oregon, help coach the kids programs in the state of Oregon without having this avenue that amateur wrestling has allowed me to do. So I'm here to, you know, support anything to stop this bill from going through the way it is written right now. And like Rick said, again, I'll cover the extreme fighting portion of this bill when we go about that. So if there's any questions.
All right. I think we're probably ready to go to this extreme fighting thing in a second. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair, just a clarifying question. When you talk about the law being overly broad, you're talking about this bill. You're not talking about the existing law. Is that correct?
I'm referring to the new bill. Yes, Senator Burdick.
All right. So you want to talk about extreme fighting?
Well, I wonder if I might add one more thing with respect to amateur wrestling in the bill, Mr. Chairman, and that is this. As a lawyer, I read a good many laws. Some are clear, some are not. This particular statute reads kind of like the tax code. You have to read it about 20 times before you even get a feel for about where they're going. And it seems to have taken place over a number of legislative sessions, and I'm not certain that each time it was adjusted, they fully contemplated what was happening in previous sessions. There is a provision with regard to tax on gate receipts. I think that probably needs to be adjusted as well with respect to amateur wrestling. It can be read to require that an amateur wrestling event, for example, if up at Canby High School, they're very successful kids program, if they put on an amateur event in the summer to qualify for a state tournament, that they would be required to pay a tax on the gross receipts that they generate. And to the extent that that could be adjusted, I'd make a recommendation along those lines. The bill has not been adjusted in any respect on that particular issue.
Yeah, I think if I remember my history on this issue, we used to have a boxing and wrestling commission that didn't sanction any kind of boxing and wrestling events in Oregon at all, which was problematic because there were programs that wanted to come in and stage events. So I think it did have something to do with those gate receipt fees and some other issues that kind of opened the door a little bit to bringing some programs to Oregon.
But well, I think you're right, Chairman, but as you read it, I think when you go through it and you look where they want to capture the gate receipts, they have in mind a professional event.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Rick, did you want to say anything?
Yeah, I'm Chael. I would, Senator Menace, I would love to comment on something. As far as this law goes, they have exemptions, and that is for school-to-school competition. There is also an exemption for an athlete that wishes to train or participate in an Olympic sport. That is where freestyle and Greco-Roman comes in. Now, the problem is the collegiate-style events, Senator Menace, that you referred to earlier, that's not exempt unless it's held from school-to-school competition. Now, the State Boxing and Wrestling Commission very clearly is set up for boxing. They also regulate professional wrestling, what we know as the sham sport today. The problem that they don't understand amateur wrestling and why that's a problem is there is the collegiate style events, which are not Olympic events, so they don't fall under the exemption, that are held in this state every single Saturday in three different high schools in the state. Now these are ran by the clubs, ages 5 on up to 15 and 16 year olds. That's the cutoff for the age. They're ran in three separate arenas, one in Portland, one over near Pendleton, Hermiston area, and one in the southern part of the state. These don't fall under the exemptions. These are ran for the kids in the community. Almost every school district in this state has a wrestling club. Again, this isn't school-to-school competition. The state would have the right to come in and regulate this. Right. And that's a big problem.
Right. And these clubs are what kind of – would it be like the Multnomah Athletic Club?
It would be exactly like the Multnomah Athletic Club, the Peninsula Park Wrestling Club, which produces Olympians, the All-Phase Wrestling Club, the Cobra Wrestling Club, the Westland Wrestling Club, the Salem Wrestling Club. Yeah.
All right. Good. Now, do you want to talk about extreme fighting?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The extreme fighting statute and its amendments has kind of a history through the – Circuit Court over in Judge Lipscomb's court in Marion County. Mr. Sonnen used to run the Full Contact Fighting Federation, and they put on Rumble at the Roseland shows. These have been extremely successful shows. They're almost always sold out. I believe they're always sold out. They're run according to strict safety rules, strict guidelines, trained referees, medical personnel on site. And they're, put it bluntly, extremely well-run shows. The state has made an attempt through the old statute to stop these shows by temporary injunctions and temporary restraining orders, and preliminary injunctions. They have not been successful so far. The first attempt to shut Mr. Sonnen's shows down came by trying to match the nature of the show up with the old extreme fighting statute as a no-hold-barred competition. Evidence was put on that the shows and the competition is conducted under mixed martial arts or pancration rules that are fairly well established, borrowed heavily from the State of Nevada Boxing and Wrestling Commission rules, but with an overlay of additional safety rules and concerns. The Department of Justice failed in their first attempt to obtain a restraining order. Show was put on subsequent to that, and the next show was scheduled. The state again filed a motion for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction, this time alleging that amateur wrestling, because Judge Lipscomb found that pancration fit the definition of wrestling.
What's the word you're using?
Pancration.
What is it?
It's a Greek term, pancrase.
I don't know Greek.
Yeah, it's a form of mixed martial arts. It actually was an Olympic sport till 1904, and it is the sport you would recognize today as ultimate fighting.
I mean, is it striking? Is it?
They're striking with there's padded gloves. There's certain striking. You may basically what it is a combination of wrestling, jiu-jitsu, judo, and boxing.
Okay.
All right.
The next attempt on the part of the state was to allege that the shows were governed by the Boxing and Wrestling Commission and extending the Boxing and Wrestling Commission's bailiwick to amateur events. As a matter of fact, the Department of Justice passed an emergency administrative rule expanding the scope of the commission's authority to cover amateur events. The end result of that particular temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction motion was that the state failed because Judge Lipscomb found that the statute did not extend to amateur events, that the statute specifically governed professional boxing and professional wrestling. The state is back now attempting to govern those events by altering the statute to govern amateur events. Now, the difficulty with the particular statute is I think it doesn't fully contemplate what the events are about. And soon I'll turn it over to Mr. Sonnen and Mr. Lindland, and they can expound on that. But there's an attempt to stop this based on safety issues and based on a previous preamble of the statute, which indicated that these are people participate in incompatible combat styles, and therefore there's a safety issue. I'll end my testimony by saying that I have watched these things closely. They're very well regulated. There is an extreme amount of safety concern on the part of the promoters, the officials, and particularly the contestants who wouldn't participate if they thought there was a danger. Mr. Sonnen's shows have never had a serious injury, and if you would compare that to high school football or basketball, I think you'd find there'd be greater injuries there. So I'll turn it over now to Mr. Sonnen and Mr. Lindman.
All right, if we could, I want to try to advance this and redeem the time a little bit.
Okay, Chairman Menace, members of the committee. As far as the fighting issue goes, I don't think safety's a question. The state's never brought it up. No one's ever been hurt in this state in one of these pancration events. There's all sorts of rules. I don't think that's a concern. The main issue here is money. They want to be able to tax it and regulate it. And putting restrictions on an amateur sport has never been done in this state or anywhere else in this country. It is an amateur sport. These competitors are matched up evenly. These competitors are well trained. These competitors are well informed. These competitors do not compete for money. They compete for intrinsic value. And anytime you can take people that set goals, that work hard to achieve these goals and have desire to obtain this and take it away from them, that's not right to do. And the fact that the state's coming after money, these shows are ran. We've got the OWA. We have to answer to USA Wrestling. We have to answer to the FCFF. Further restrictions are not needed for an amateur event. It's just flat wrong to do. And the restrictions are a guise to end the sport. And the sport is having a hard enough time without the state coming in on an amateur level. The organizations that I just mentioned, whether it's the OSAA, whether it's the NCAA, whether it's USA Wrestling, has so many restrictions that one has to follow. These are well-known organizations with essentially zero complaints filed in their history. The Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission, in its time, has not yet to prove its effectiveness on a professional level, and we should not open the doors for it to try on an amateur level. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Mr. Sonnen?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I think Mr. Sonnen did a fairly good job. I'm actually a competitor at a professional level in this sport, and this sport is very, very new. Since 1993, and it's evolved since then, and we've came in with many rules and regulations to help the sport grow and help the sport evolve. And to label it as extreme fighting or no holds barred is very unfair to the sport, because it is a mixed martial arts event where trained competitive athletes prepare for an event, go into an arena, and compete. And what we're doing, labeling it as an extreme fighting or no holds barred, I feel is very unfair to this sport, because it's now regulated in many states, Nevada and New Jersey, which I'm going to compete in actually 2 weeks from now. I'll be competing in New Jersey at the professional level in this sport. But what I would like to see is eventually the state of Oregon adopting the same rules that Nevada and New Jersey and many other states have adopted to regulate this sport in its entirety, and not only on the amateur level but on the professional level, where we can bring crowds into the stadiums and fill up arenas where I can fight in front of my hometown crowd instead of have to fight out on the East Coast or in Nevada. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I apologize for call you Mr. Sonnen. You're not. You're Mr. Linden. So, okay. Thank you very much. And I kind of did this in reverse order. Generally, I bring the proponents of the bill first, but you all signed up first, so it's my mistake. Yeah.
Okay.
But
it's nice to thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
You guys can now sit back and listen to what the department proponents have to say about the bill. I'm remembering this bill because I was the chair of the House Judiciary Committee in 97 when we passed it. Prohibition.
Mr. Chair, I need to see one of these.
You need to see one?
Pay-per-view.
Wait till the end of the session.
Yeah, don't up close and personal.
Yeah, exactly.
Matt.
All right. Yes, please. All right. Okay. Roland, you're going to have to help me to pronounce your last name.
It's Iparigary.
Say what?
Iparigary.
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 Okay.
It's like two Garys, a pair of Garys.
Right.
Iparigary.
Don't confuse me anymore.
That's the best way to describe it.
Who's going to start off here?
I'll start off, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Bob Miller. I'm the director of the Gaming Enforcement Division for the Oregon State Police. I'm also the Oregon Boxing Wrestling Commission comes under my area of responsibility. I appear here today before you on behalf of the Oregon State Police and the Oregon Boxing Wrestling Commission to urge your support of Senate Bill 178. The proposed changes to Oregon Revised Chapter 463 that are contemplated in this bill are consistent with previous actions taken by the legislature. Oregon public policy related to extreme fighting is clearly articulated in ORS 463-018. Subsection 2 reads that the Legislative Assembly further finds that the entertainment spectacle commonly known as extreme fighting is a violent exhibition that is excessively and unacceptably dangerous to the participants and is promoted and advertised to that end. Extreme fighting lacks appropriate restrictions on dangerous blows or life-threatening maneuvers, and the matching of participants with incompatible styles of fighting make it impossible for the state to regulate extreme fighting in a way that can reasonably protect the safety of the participants. And it is therefore an appropriate exercise of the authority of the state of Oregon to prohibit extreme fighting and similarly named combative events, sports. That is the current express policy of the legislature. Now, extreme fighting is defined by statute as a no-holds-barred match, competition, or exhibition that combines elements of boxing, wrestling, or martial arts without a system of rules approved by the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission. Now, up until last year, the commission had been successful in preventing extreme wrestling events within the state. A circuit court ruling that's been referred to earlier created a loophole that wasn't envisioned by the drafters of this this public policy. And what that loophole did and what the judge did not rule that the commission didn't have authority to regulate amateur wrestling. What the judge ruled was that if the events barred one hold, then it was an extreme fighting by definition, by statute. And so that's what we're attempting to do through this proposal, is to close that loophole and give the commission the ability to enforce a public policy that was expounded by this legislature. As you know, I'm joined by Roland Iparigary, Assistant Attorney General, who drafted this language and has been involved in this litigation at the circuit court level.
All right. I'm going to call you Roland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to start off by answering a few of the questions that were raised by the by Mr. Franklin and Mr. Sonnen and Mr. Linland. One of the things that they referred to was that it was the state that called it a no-holds-barred competition, when in fact, if you look at the exhibit or attachment that I gave you, I think six pages in, it's attachment B. This is Mr. Sonnen's organization, the Full Contact Fighting Federation. He's a registered agent. It's a limited liability company. And if you look at attachment B, they themselves call this a no-holds-barred competition. And what happened was when we...
I'm not tracking you. Where is this?
It's in the thick attachment that I provided for you.
Thank you.
And if you look at attachment B, I think it's the sixth page in. This is from their website, from the Full Contact Fighting Federation's website. And they promoted this as a no-holds-barred. As you can see, this is not the kind of wrestling, high school wrestling and Olympic wrestling that they were coming in to tell you about. This is, in fact, cage fighting that they mention in their materials. And they also charge, as you can see by the tickets on the loose exhibit, this was just photocopied today for their next upcoming match, $22, $35, and $72 per ticket. This is for the amateur event that they're promoting. Now, on our first court action against the Full Contact Fighting Federation, we had no choice but to call it no holds barred because that's how they were describing their fight. But you see, with groups like this, this is, and I think their testimony was that this is a fairly new sport since 93, I think. It's very easy for them to adapt. So they came into court and they said, oh no, we bar one or two holds. So Judge Lipscomb then found that they were no longer extreme fighting because they no longer barred all holds. So it was very easy for them to adapt. The sport stayed the same, as you can see from the pictures attached to this. These are not wrestling events. There's kicking, there's punching. I don't think USA Wrestling allows kicking and punching in their sport, but this is what we're talking about here. This is the kind of sport activity that was prohibited by the legislature. And what we're doing here, again, is closing up the loophole that was created by this no-holds-barred language. There's no necessity for the no-holds-barred language, and that's why we took it off, because it was very easy for them to adapt. I think, on my part, what I want to refer to as extreme fighting and what the commission feels is very dangerous, is very new. If it's being more accepted by other states, maybe that's the case, maybe that's not. But why should Oregon be the guinea pig in this sport that's still evolving? And that is one of the problems that the commission faces, a very serious problem that they look at. That's all I want to say about extreme fighting. If I may, I can continue to talk about the changes and the law, how it affects.
Let me ask a couple of questions. I was the chair of the House Judiciary Committee in 1997 when we passed the prohibition on extreme fighting, and it's been a while, but I'm trying to recall. I think our assumptions and testimony then was such that there was a belief that these kind of fights would result in significant injury or harm to individuals if they were not somehow regulated. So that's my recollection. I could go back, I guess, and pull the tapes. But can you point to significant injury or harm that's been done to any particular individual who's participated in one of these fights?
Well, it's been difficult to monitor them because we don't regulate them. As you can see, they are saying we don't have a regulatory authority, even though we've been trying. We are currently in litigation with them, so I don't know of any. I know the commissioner has requested materials from all 50 states on that issue, and I don't know if Mr.
I guess what I want to do is, if we're gonna go to the extent of regulating these things, there has to be some justification, some foundation for a compelling state action.
Well,
and if there's no one who we can point to that says they've been injured or hurt or somehow harmed by this activity, you know, I'd be hard-pressed at this point to say we ought to regulate it any more than we're currently regulating. So you're going to have to demonstrate to me.
Well, we're not currently regulating it as extreme fighting. Extreme fighting prohibits this kind of activity.
Well, I understand, but you're still going to have to give me some foundation or basis for the state intervention and action. Because what I'm telling you is in 1997 we had certain assumptions and assumed that people were going to be hurt. If you can't demonstrate that individuals have been hurt or injured by this, or there's a strong likelihood that these kind of events would result in the injury or potential death of an individual unregulated, I'd be hard-pressed to say we should move ahead.
Well, sure. Let me start off. If you look at the pictures, the gloves there that they're wearing are basically to protect the hands of the fighters. They're not there to protect the other fighter. They're just thin, fingerless gloves. Another move that's allowed, and I have the rules here if you would like to see them, is a knee to the head. You can hit somebody with your knee to the head.
Right.
So it's not a matter of has somebody died in Oregon?
No. I've sat through a lot of public hearings before on issues that are highly controversial. And if there's someone who's harmed, generally there's an audience full of people who are saying, my husband participated in this event and he got the living daylights whacked out of him and I think it's a horrible thing and you ought to ban it. Or some, and I'm using that as an example, but generally there are people who come in here and say, by God, this is a serious problem that needs to be resolved. There is no one in the audience.
Well, in May of this year, or of last year, two people died in Texas in an Ultimate Tough Man contest. So that has not happened in this state that I'm aware of.
Okay. So, if that's a potentiality, and if that's what we're trying to regulate, then that's what I want you to establish. I want to establish the ground for what we're attempting to do here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could,
sure.
Bob Miller, you make an extremely valid point, and I've done some research on the Internet attempting to get my hands around this. I also was a high school wrestler and did some wrestling in college. I love wrestling. This isn't wrestling. There are some anecdotal stories on the Internet. I've also had to look at professional wrestling, and there are anecdotal stories on the Internet about people getting killed in extreme fighting, ultimate fighting type of deals. Most of the things I was able to find are actually occurred in foreign countries. But what I did find that I think might be very telling, and I've followed professional wrestling since Muhammad Ali with Cassius Clay, had a brother who wanted to be a professional boxer, and I've, in the last 5-6 years, I've probably attended over 100 professional, or watched 100 professional boxing matches live. What I did find on the Full Contact Fighting Federation, one of the gentlemen here's group, is a listing of the fight results that they've had up at the Roseland Theater. And, for example, if you look at the December 14, 2002 Rumble at the Roseland 5, what you find is out of 10 fights, 8 were stopped in the first round. They were either stopped by the referee, they were stopped by tap out, the towel was thrown in, or submission holds. Now, the difference between what I see here and what I see in the professional boxing ring is that because there is a great deal of matchmaking, review, matching up of contestants, most matches don't end in the first round. Most matches of a well-matched professional boxing go the distance. 8 out of 10 were stopped in the first round. 9 out of 10 didn't go the distance. There was only one that went the distance to a decision. I think that's a clear indication, Mr. Chair, that this is a pretty intense, violent sport and that the contestants aren't as equally matched as one might think.
All right. Well, let me play the devil's advocate here. Somebody threw the towel in. Somebody stopped the fight. Somebody said enough is enough. Can we demonstrate that someone was actually injured?
See, me, somebody was in trouble.
Injured or hurt?
Hurt.
Do you understand what I'm getting at here?
I understand, I mean, Mr. Chair.
Let's assume we pass the law. I mean, my next question would be, how would you regulate this event? How would you, as the person in charge of the rule making, how would you envision the rules being constructed that would regulate these kind of events?
I think that if the legislature passes the changes as proposed, that the current ban up until this last year that existed on extreme wrestling would continue.
You would basically ban these kind of events by rule.
I'm sorry?
You would ban these events.
Up until the adverse ruling in the circuit court, they were banned in Oregon.
Correct.
Extreme fighting events. This event, these events were advertised as extreme fighting,
right.
No holds barred.
Right. But event. See, the difficulty that you have with me today is I was the chair in the House in 1997. I remember specifically what it is we thought we were prohibiting. You can't demonstrate to me right now, based on any factual circumstance, that there's something to prohibit. And until you can do, I wouldn't be inclined to move a bill.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, the position that the commission finds itself in, and I apologize for Dr. Lou Rios, the physician member of the commission who wanted to be here this morning and couldn't attend,
right.
Is that they're under an ethical, moral, and legal obligation to recommend to the state rules and procedures that they believe protect the participants of sports.
Right.
When they see people put in an octagonal cage, when they see them put into a situation where they can get kicked on the ground, they can all of these sorts of things, it is so contrary to what their mission is to protect participants and the public, mm-hmm. that they have to speak out.
Well, but now, let me give you an example there. I think the fear factor program on television to me is highly offensive. I can't stand watching somebody eating bugs and doing some of the
things. I've never watched the show.
They do. Well, I mean, you ought to. I personally think it's offensive. I can't watch some of these people do what they're asked to do. But just because it's offensive to me, and I think it might be harmful in my, based on my perception, doesn't mean that I should regulate it out of its existence. So, I mean, I look at the construction of the law in the Constitution of the United States and Oregon with a certain degree of reverence. If we cannot justify a foundation and a basis to prohibit something, there's no rational nexus between harm to some person or some evil, then we ought not be there. We ought not be regulating it. Now, if you can come to me and say, here's why it needs to be regulated, and here's how we envision the regulation, then I might be sympathetic to you. But what you're telling me is that based on your intent, you would ban these kind of programs. I don't see the harm so far. I mean, maybe other committee members do. But I don't see it. Senator Ringo.
Mr. Chair, I really appreciate where you're coming from. And I think you're right on target, but I do want to suggest something to you. I am not an expert in these events, but I suspect that that when there are a lot of repeated physical blows to the head, that there is injury. You know, and we all see how Muhammad Ali talks now. And I'm not at all offended by the shape of a ring or what you describe as activity, but if you were to bring somebody before this committee, a physician, with evidence as to what repeated blows to the head, what that does to the person in terms of causing cognitive or mental impairment, I would find that very persuasive. I really would. And I have a feeling that's the kind of evidence that the chair is seeking as well. And I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of harm is occurring. I just don't want to assume that it is.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I apologize for not being as prepared as perhaps we could have been today. The assumption that I made was that the legislature made that decision previously that they were going to ban extreme fighting. I didn't know that debate today was going to be whether or not extreme
right.
fighting should or shouldn't be.
Right.
My purpose in being here today was to point out to the legislature that a loophole
right.
that didn't otherwise exist was now created. If now we find ourselves in a position where we're going to debate whether or not extreme fighting should or should not occur in the state, we can certainly be prepared to do that.
Right.
I just have another question about the bill. I mean, it seems to do a couple different things. Obviously, one's relating to extreme fighting. The other has to do with amateur wrestling. And I don't know if the council can touch on that for a minute as to...
Yeah. Do you want to... There were some other issues that were raised.
Yeah. I'm curious why the Department of State Police is even in the business of regulating amateur wrestling. I mean, that's a sport. It doesn't seem to need to be a law enforcement issue at all.
Right. Mr. Chair... Senator Ringo, think it was back in 1993 when then Governor Roberts, I believe, consolidated a number of commissions and state agencies, and they were looking for a home for the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and for better or for worse, it landed with the state police, and so we've been dealing with that issue ever since.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I ask a couple of questions about, let's say there is an event with a gate, like at the Roseland, for example, but the combatants are not paid. Under current law, is that an amateur event?
It is.
And in this situation where Judge Lipscomb gives a, my understanding, there's been he's okayed or said that this is not no holds barred and that it can go on. Now, my understanding is there's still a tax on that. Is that correct?
That's true. And I want to make one clarification. Judge Lipscomb, first of all, did say that if you bar one hold, it's no longer extreme fighting, therefore the loophole was created. But secondly, as Mr. Franklin testified, Judge Lipscomb did not say that the commission does not regulate amateur wrestling, and there is no order to that effect.
Okay.
So I'm not sure where that information came from, but that is not the court's ruling. And in this case, now we're getting away from extreme fighting. Let's move into the wrestling, to the amateur wrestling statutory changes or amendments. That would also not apply only to amateur wrestling, but amateur boxing, because by the same argument that they have made regarding the state shouldn't regulate amateur wrestling, the same argument could be made for amateur boxing. What the commission wants to do is they want to regulate and protect professional fighters and wrestlers the same way that they protect amateur fighters and wrestlers, boxers and wrestlers. And there is an exemption for certain amateur events. So certainly there was legislative intent already. It's an ORS 463210. This statute, this part of the statute already exempts amateur events. So clearly the intent was to include within its jurisdiction amateur competitions. Otherwise, it would not have exempted some. And as you pointed out, counsel, there's also the tax on gross receipts part of it that also applies to amateur and professionals. And it's clear that it applies to amateur. It says amateur right on the language of it, and that is 463330. And the title of this statute is Amateur Events Admission Fee Distribution Tax. And it talks about when admission fee is charged by any person conducting or sponsoring an amateur boxing or wrestling event. The only clarification that we need, this chapter, we just need to make consistent. That's why we propose the changes to 463113, because that is the only place where it doesn't say that the commission is limited to regulating professional boxing or in wrestling. It just says the commission is created to regulate boxing or wrestling. But then we have all these other statutes that allow regulation of amateur boxing and wrestling. So what we want is consistency.
Yes, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then let me ask you a follow-up question that I'm still a bit confused on. Let's say there is a club sport at the MAC club or at one of these high schools. It's not the educational institutions themselves, but clubs, and it's amateur. Currently, is there an exemption process for that? Is it necessary to get an exemption, and how does that process work?
I think because these issues are clearly new to this commission, what the commission would have to do is go back to the statutory language of 463110 and duly recognize some organizations. If it's just going to be 13-year-old boys wrestling in a mat club, then the commission needs to come up with something. And they have the authority to do so by the legislature under 463210. So that is not the problem as far as the commission sees it. The problem is if they are not allowed to protect contestants of both amateur and professional, competitions like the Ultimate Tough Man, where they come in and they basically, it's just a brawl. They get two kids in a bar and they say, you're going to fight each other, and there's not going to be any regulatory activity on part of the state. That is a problem. And I think what the commission wants to do is make sure that the chapter is consistent in protecting both amateur and professional wrestlers and boxers.
All right. Help me understand on page 2 line 2 that starts with subsection B, section 2. It says a person may not act as a referee, judge, second. I'm not sure what a second is. Somebody might explain that to me. Timekeeper, matchmaker, ticket taker. Then it says security officer or box office employee of amateur boxing, wrestling matches, competitions, or exhibitions until the person is licensed as required in this subsection, unless the person is exempted from licensing and bonding requirements under 463.210. Now, the legislature has also seen fit to, I'm not sure if we call it licensure or certification of security officers to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and that this section seems inconsistent with or in addition to the regulation by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for security officers. Can you reconcile that for me?
I'm not sure where the inconsistency is. Exemption in 463.210 would allow the universities and the National Guard and those organizations from having to license their security officers.
Right, but why would you want to license through the Boxing and Wrestling Commission a security officer if they're already certified through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training? Why would you want to do that?
I guess I'm not aware that every security personnel that might show up in a tough man contest or full contact fighting contest is going to be licensed.
Well, I think under that statute, I could be wrong, but I think they would have to be under that department law. That law, and there are some exemptions, but they generally deal with corporations that have particular proprietary security services that are internal. But we can look at that. Okay. Well, any other questions? All right. Mr. Miller, I think you're going to have to come back to me at some point with a larger justification, clarification, what it is we think we're regulating. How long have they been actually doing these fights since the Lipscomb decision?
About a year and a half, I think.
About a year and a half. So over a period of a year and a half, we're going to need to demonstrate, I think, some basis. Now, if you can bring, you know, physicians or other individuals who can, as Senator Ringo mentioned, articulate some damage or harm or thing that we're trying to regulate and prohibit, then I'm fine with that and I'm open to it and bring this back. But
sure.
I want to see that before we...
Right. And I want to make it also clear, I think the commission is that we're talking about two separate issues, extreme fighting, prohibition. The legislature started long ago.
Right.
And that's different from the regulatory authority to also regulate amateur events, and I think that's clear in the chapter already. We just want to make sure that it is consistent.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And, you know, you have to, I guess, understand that I was here in 1997 at a time when the Boxing and Wrestling Commission didn't sanction anything. They basically prohibited everything. And there were individuals in the state that did want professional boxing matches in particular to be sanctioned, allowed. And I believe the former director, Mr. Anderson, had some issues with that, and there were some innuendo about certain promoters being, you know, perhaps not the most legally sound individuals coming to the state. There was a desire to keep that element out, but, you know, so things have kind of evolved, and now we've had some professional boxing matches, and now this is existing. So help me understand it, exactly what it is we think we're trying to do here. Okay? Any other business before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.